invitation to come back. My ministry was actually at Grace Community Church yesterday. We had a conference, and I always use that as an opportunity to skip over to Faith Community Church to hear Pastor Anderson's message. So I sent an email to Tim, say, hey, can I crash your Sunday school class? Because if I don't have an assigned place to speak, I'll get assigned a place to speak, which then I won't get a chance to hear Pastor Anderson preach. So Tim is always kind enough to let me come into the Sunday school class. So I'll do the Sunday school class, and then we'll get a chance to hear the sermon. I would like to present for you one of the lessons I did yesterday at the Grace Community Church conference. Now, I had an easy lesson, and I had a hard lesson. And Tim told me, he assured me that you guys are smarter than the average bear. Something like that. And so we're going to do the...
Sorry.
That's okay. There's always a bell curve. Anyway, so here's a quickie question to you. Should science inform public policy? That's a good one. No, you don't need to answer on that. And the next one would be, how should science inform public policy? Because we're dealing with that a lot. But here's even a better question. Should Scripture inform science? And Pastor Shaking said, yes, this is an obvious answer. Yes, Scripture should inform science. And this lesson, which will be the harder of the two lessons today, is going to show how Scripture will inform us of this passage in Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1 for all of us. And just for the sake of time, we'll start at verse 18 and go down to verse 25. It says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Because that which may be known about God is evident within them. For God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood by the things that he has made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks. But they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and birds and four-footed beasts and animals and crawling things. Therefore, God gave them over to the lust of their hearts to impurity, that their bodies might be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who's blessed forever." How, you know, back a few thousand years ago, you could easily see if someone made a golden calf, worshipping a idol, worshipping an image, or ascribing it to something in nature, you could see that. Is this being worked out today? Do we see an exchange of truth of God for a lie? Do we see a worship and service of the creation? Well, I'd like to talk about that. And as always, the screen goes blank if we don't do something on it for quite some time. And everybody loves a whiteboard talk. So I thought, let's do a whiteboard talk right here. Except, you know, I won't have to actually write because voila, I just magically wrote on this whiteboard. Even in like whiteboard type of things. Can everybody see this here? And This is going to be one of these talks that's going to kind of like stretch your thinking and twist your mind a little bit, because I'm going to talk about selectionism, this whole idea that nature can select for or against creatures in the popular concept that you all were taught in high school called natural what?
Selection.
Natural selection. And there's two types. There's an atheistic type, which is prominent, but there's a theistic type, which we have. And I'm going to apply design analysis, because before I went to medical school, I was stationed out here at Port Hueneme as a civil engineer. And so I understand a little bit about design analysis to show that these are mystical beliefs, totally mystical beliefs. And we set that up by looking at causes, going right back to the beginning, something that we used to do all the time, looking at the true or primary cause. true causes? What are the, I'm not talking about the first cause, in this particular case, God, but what is the true cause of something happening? Now, this is kind of a scientific talk, so we're going to have to read some of these quotes. And this researcher, who is a believer, he recently wrote a book, and this he has a very good summary comment about what we used to do in science. From the beginning of modern science, science have championed the idea of looking for the true cause, or identifying the true or vera causa. Early modern scientists affirm this principle as one of the key aspects of scientific approach to understanding nature, which stood in opposition to magical thinking. So if something happened, people often ascribed it to magic, or they ascribed it to unseen forces like demons or angels. And this was saying, no, no, let's look for the true cause of why something is happening. So causality is really important. And this whole talk is going to be one of contrasting two explanations for causality. Here's your probably your favorite astrophysicist, Stephen Hawking, probably one of the supposed smartest men in nature. He wrote a book about 2 years ago called The Grand Design, and he asserts this. He says, because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Now, is he asserting a cause? Sure, he's asserting a cause. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists and why you exist. So his causality is spontaneous creation, and that's what he's going to assert. And I can assure you that many people believe this. Many people teaching at the University of California system would believe something like that. In contrast, there's another causality, and this is the same Stephen Meyer. He did probably the best job of summarizing it. He says, no, Stephen Hawking is wrong. Undirected materialistic causes, that's what Stephen Hawking was asserting, have not demonstrated the capacity to generate significant amounts of specified information. Now, what he's talking about there is all the information that's in your DNA. It's specified. It's selected. Somebody selected this, 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 and this, and put it in your DNA as the code to make a human being. That's what he's talking about. And he's saying undirected causes cannot do that. At the same time, conscious intelligence agency, someone with a brain, has repeatedly shown the capacity to produce such information. So he's saying, no, Stephen Hawking's wrong when he says the spontaneous creation is why everything exists and why we exist. He said, no, there was an agent. Every time we look at, we see specified information, we always see something with a brain or an agent producing it. It follows that mind, and this is key, conscious, rational agency. What philosophers call agent causation stands as the only cause of producing these things. So, are you an agent? Do you guys have agency? Sure you do. You have agency. Does God have agency? Yes. Do any animals have agency? Sure they do. You know, do you have dogs that can make conscious, rational decisions and things like that? Your what? Well, that was it. Your dog exercises agency in spades. Is that what you're saying? There, yes. It's this something that is life that exercises this agency. So we're going to have agent causation as opposed to spontaneous natural causation. And in terms of living things, this was summarized by William Dembski in a book, Design Revolution, in naturalism. That's Stephen Hawking's view. Nature is all there is. Matter is all there is. It's all that's ever existed. He asks, in terms of living things, this important question. What then constrains the reproduction of living things in nature? Clearly, nature itself. Nature, as it were, selects those organisms that will reproduce and eliminates those that will not. So, in that statement, where do you see nature exercising agency? Nature, as it were, what? Selects those organisms that will reproduce. And this is how you'll see this projection of agency onto nature. Nature is going to select. Thus, according to Darwin, nature itself constitutes the supreme animal breeder that shapes the path of life on Earth. This is in total contrast to God creating everything after its kind. So we have nature exercising agency. Now the key question is, why should we care about true causes? Well, we should. One, for the sake of truth. And two, thank you for the tee up, Tim, for the Creator's glory. Because when we don't ascribe true causality, when God is the true cause, we rob Him of His glory. Which takes us back to Romans chapter 1, which you see between verses 18 and 25, a wrong ascription of causality. In Romans chapter 1, it says in verse 25, they didn't change the truth of God. The NASB has it translated correctly. They exchanged the truth of God and worshipped and served the creature. It's really just the cosmos more than the Creator. So we have set up in Romans chapter 1 exactly what we see being played out today. We have an exchange of causality. So this isn't really semantics at all, because like that perfect picture I drew of the Bible right there. The Bible clearly declares God creates nature. Nature does not create God. Nature does not create itself. But God creates nature. And we see evidences of Him creating nature when we see specified or selective complexity. As an engineer, I specified things all the time. And in your body, you have specified things which identifies an agent. So even though nobody saw God directly create things, everybody has seen something created. This little clicker on my hand, it did not create itself, and we all know that, and it has features that it didn't create itself. It has a lot of multiple parts working together for a purpose. Do you have multiple parts working together for a purpose? Of course you do. This didn't create itself. This had a creator. Ergo, from Romans chapter 1, everybody that has ever lived must at least make this deduction. I must have had a creator. I must have had a creator on that, which fits right with Romans chapter 1, verse 20. This explanation stands in contrast to Stephen Hawking's explanation, in which he supposes that nature creates itself. Now, how in their worldview would they ever assert such a thing, which is so counterintuitive? How would they assert that? It's because in their worldview, since you begin with nature and all there is, that environmental stressors, like we hear outside right now, all kinds of stressors. And I notice in Southern California you have a massive stress going on right now. It's a what?
Drought.
It's a big drought. Yeah, all the trees kind of look grayish and not green. It's these stresses which drive organisms through space and time, shaping them. Now, does someone say, where did you get that? I'll show you headlines from at least 10 scientific papers which assert this. Insect herbivores, those are insects which eat plants, they drive real-time ecological and evolutionary change in plant populations. So it's the insects which are driving the plants along. Dry conditions spurred the advance of photosynthesis. The need to conserve water was the vital role in driving plants towards photosynthesis. So since photosynthesis exists, you have to explain its origination. It was dry conditions which drove those things on. Environment controls gene expression. I'll speed up through some of these. Natural enemies drive geographic variation in plant defenses. On that, Darwin's greatest discovery, mutation and selection, have jointly driven the marvelous process of, essentially, they're going to say, the diversity of life on Earth as we see it. This is a chapter from a leading textbook, which was just published 2 years ago. The environment as a... Now, in this particular case, it even goes beyond a stressor. The environment is a what? A normal agent. It's an agent producing phenotypes. Those are your various traits. Insect herbivores drive the evolution of plants. Geology and climate drive diversification. Geology and this have been known to shape and mold biodiversity, which is summed up in this really good book by two evolutionists, Kirshner and Gerhardt, The Plausibility of Life, where he summarizes the natural view held by Darwin and most everyone today. He, Darwin, accepted the view, this is really important, that the environment directly instructs the organism how to vary. He proposed a mechanism for inheriting those changes. The organism is like modeling clay. And remolding of the clay meant that each of the billions of little grains was free to move a little bit in any direction to generate new form. If an organism needed a wing, opposable thumb, longer legs, webbed feet, blah, 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 it would emerge under the proper selective conditions with time. So can you see, in summary, what they're saying? nature is clearly doing what? Shaping, molding, guiding, designing all of the organisms over a long period of time. The organisms are passive and they're just like what? Modeling clay. Being shaped by those kinds of things. And that's how they would explain everything, every trait on your body. So, geology and climate drive it, which then leads to the assertion that the environment exercises agency, causing the design of life. Oh, that's just the person practicing over there. I thought it was someone's cell phone. I thought, wow. That's better than Ring of Fire. So, this is really important. The environment is going to exercise agency causing life's design. And going back to this paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy, with Darwin's discovery of natural selection, the origin and adaptation of organisms were brought into the realm of science. Adaptive features of organisms could now be explained like any natural phenomena, the result of natural process without recourse to an intelligent designer. Darwin's theory of natural selection accounts for the design of organisms and their wondrous diversity, the result of a natural process which is not conscious. So everything is here. Everything looks like it was designed because there is a substitute agent, not a God agent, a natural agent. The natural agent is what?
Nature
itself. Nature itself. Nature itself is designing. Nature itself creates itself. Nature itself then designs itself. Now, if you didn't believe in God, what would you have besides nature? Nothing. Nothing. So you must express this worldview that Darwin's greatest discovery is design without a designer, which is in contrast to this view where God creates nature. Now, are there any biblical passages which may give us a clue as to when and why organisms needed to adapt? Yes. We would go all the way back to the first book of the Bible, the first chapter of the book of the Bible, and the Lord gives a command to the creatures, and then he also gives it to Adam and Eve, where he tells them to be fruitful, multiply, and do what?
Fill
the earth. Fill the earth. Now, why was that command given? Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. This is a primary cause. And I think it was up here as number one. That is a way to glorify the Lord through self-revelation. And I'll tell you why very quickly. If I design something that is static, that may be a great design accomplishment. But when I design something which can automatically self-adjust under varying conditions, like a plane that can fly on autopilot, fly over things and around things, and cars that can go on cruise control, when I design things that can self-adjust, that is an incredible design accomplishment. And so not only do we see creatures with all their incredible designs, we see creatures which can be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Now, at the beginning of creation, was earth static or dynamic? It was dynamic. It was dynamic. How do we know it was dynamic? Because in one, it says that there would be days and nights. Is that a dynamic process on the earth? It says that there would be seasons. Now, you guys don't get a whole lot of seasons here, but in places where they do get it, like Powell, Wyoming, that might be a dynamic process. And then the very act of filling the earth makes it dynamic. Because as soon as I'm living in this environment and I move into your environment, I have just changed it for that person or that thing. So organisms always needed to adapt. And as we, if say we were living at that time, we were watching the creatures, even as we see them today, we see them move into all kinds of challenging niches. We see their great capacity to solve those problems. And we as Christians say, wow, these creatures are incredibly designed. And this was the reason for doing that. So I'm expecting to find, based on that, specified systems within organisms that enable them to not, this is in total contrast, not be driven through space and time as passive little things by the environment shaping and molding them, but oh, to the contrary. Organisms drive themselves through space and time, taking on all kinds of environmental challenges, solving those challenges, and moving into different environments. And what's really important about this is it was not, ooh, erase this from your brain. It was not to survive. And how do I know it was not to survive? Because Adam doesn't sin until chapter 3. So there was no death. There was no struggle. This whole purpose of adapting is to reveal great design, to glorify a great designer. So, if you guys here are expressing traits that can live in Southern California, and this is, let's say, post-creation, and you guys are expressing traits that may enable you to live in a burned-out wasteland. Let's say you move to Texas or something like that over there. What happens to these guys? Do they have to die? No. You guys just stay here in Southern California, and you guys move over to Texas. And then you reproduce, and some of your children are expressing traits which enable them to move to Kansas. Well, what happens to you? You stay in Texas and they move to Kansas. And then their children express traits. And over time, organisms are expressing traits enabling them to fill all the earth, but nothing is struggling for resources and nothing is competing and nothing is having to die. That's how it should have worked. Should have worked on that. But as you already mentioned, our father Adam blew it. And that ushered in death. Now, what is death? Death is just another challenge. Death is just another challenge, and your adaptive capacity, which was put into you from the beginning of creation, was already potent enough to take on another challenge, which is death, and often, not all the time, but often solve that challenge as well. So that's where we're going with this. We're going to see which one of these two do we see. Do we see specified systems within organisms enabling them to drive themselves? Or are they these hapless little creatures being driven along through space and time in everything? So, this gal, she's out laying on the grass. I want to hit this whole importance of semantics right off the beginning. Did she walk out her front door and lay down on the grass? Or was she drug out of her front door and thrown down on the grass? Does it matter? If you're a prosecuting attorney, it might matter the causality of how she got there. So this is important because some people will say semantics. Oh, this is just semantics. And biologists get confused on semantics a lot. We say, well, she started here, she went out her front door, she's on her grass. What difference does it make of how she got there? It makes a big difference on how she got there, whether regardless if she starts and ends at the same spot, causality is really important. Which brings us to these little creatures, like blind cave fish. How many of you have heard of those? You have these same fish. Believe it or not, these two fish can mate with each other. This fish is isolated in a cave and now is blind, doesn't even express eyes, and its pigmentation is decreased. How would we normally explain that from a selectionist viewpoint? Well, we would say this fish got isolated in the cave, eyes are no longer useful, they kind of bump into things, they get disease, creatures with eyes slowly lose their eyes, and it's a loss of information over time, and after multiple generations, the fish have gone blind because nature has selected for blindness. And that's how you would explain it. And that's how creationists and evolutionists have explained it. But based on design, we should not expect that. What if there are sensors and detectors in this fish that once it finds itself in a cave environment, since organisms were designed to be what? Fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Would that include cave environments? Sure it would. What if they can detect that as their little embryos, and things can adjust so that they lose their eyes? I wrote that up in an article 3 years ago saying maybe the whole selectionist explanation is wrong. And lo and behold, in December of 2013, a paper was published indicating, you don't have to worry about it, this protein, heat shock protein 90, controls eye development. And what do you know? As these fish move into the cave, they're detecting water conductivity. Cave water is much more conductive than the other. And based on this conductivity, this protein is variably expressed, and you can express fish with full eyes, partial eyes, all the way down to no eyes. And when they have no eyes, they also have increased sensory organs for smell and touch. And all of this can happen in, think Genesis. How many generations would you think this would take to happen if organisms are going to fill the earth?
One.
One generation. These fish can go into that environment and boom, adjust, self-adjust. The cave doesn't cause it. And they now have filled this environment. Is that the first time you've heard about this? That is really incredible. I could give you many other examples of how quickly they can do this. Yes.
Observe it in one generation.
Yes. Theoretically. Observe. All of these fish are in one generation that are published in the paper. Observed. That is really incredible. That's really, really a pretty... How many of you said, wow, God must be a pretty good creator to do something like that? So, we have these two worldviews opposed to each other. So how do we explain some of those things? Well, we're going to apply design analysis because it doesn't concoct things or invent stories to this process of natural selection. Because many of my colleagues and others in the secular world assert that natural selection is a real observable process. It's a real observable process. Well, the good thing about design analysis is real processes have real observable steps. All kinds of processes have real steps. And the whole thing about asserting that it is a process isn't even a certainty itself. Michael Hodge, who is an expert on natural selection, wrote this. A quite general thing, issue has still received no canonical treatment. What kind of a thing is natural selection anyway? Is it a law, a principle, a force, a cause, an agent? All or some of these things, the view that natural selection is a law has been countered by the view that it is a principle, while that conclusion has been countered in turn by insistence that it is neither. And this may surprise many of you. There is not a consistent definition anywhere in science of what natural selection really is. But most say it's a process. So let's apply process thinking to it. If we were going to design a web, I pulled this off the web, we would go through a process with real identifiable steps as we go through a process. In biochemistry, we get the exact same thing. This is a diagram of the respiratory process. Ooh, bad memories from biochem on that. And we used to have to memorize this stuff. But the key point on this is, everybody can see, real steps, real processes, which someone actually can identify and lay them down. If you're one of those who get a tattoo and change your mind, you'll go through a tattoo removal process, where they take a little laser and burn it off your chest with a vacuum to suck away the smoke, and you'll go through all the steps of the process, including the screaming step on that. Like, wow, whoa, whoa. So just another reason not to be marking up your body on all of those things. So if we want to go through, so let's check. Let's check for adaptation. Is this a step? Is there a system in creatures to express variable traits? The answer is yes. Look around the room. We all have them. So we're expressing some kind of variable traits. We obviously know we have a reproductive system. We have a way to get those traits to our children. That's an inheritance system. We can check in the population whether there's a change of the frequency of those traits over time. And we can check to see whether those traits, that's what phenotype is, your traits, either succeed or fail. Succeed or fail. So let's just take it to a genetic engineering design process. As an engineer, do I have a way to express variable types of designs? Sure, I do. I don't have to worry about reproductive inheritance or those things. But in terms of my designs, is there a way to check to see whether my designs succeed or fail? Of course there is. And since they're my designs, they always succeed. So, on that particular case. Now, let's look at organisms. We look at any organism. They have way to reproduce traits. The O stands for observable. Inheritance. We can check for frequency. And we can check to see whether their traits succeed or fail. This is setting up a key understanding of causality. So I'll give you the tip right up front. In terms of design analysis, there's a problem out there. I design a solution. My solution either succeeds or fails. Where does causality reside? With me. With me, and by extension, the solution that I designed. What would you do if I said to you, so this is where the slip in causality is going to come into, here's a problem, I made a solution, the solution solved the problem, and you say to me, yes, the problem selected your solution. Ah, it kind of sounds funny, doesn't it? It sounds funny, but it isn't. It would actually be a subtle switch in credit and causality. Because I made a solution that was successful in solving a problem, who should get the credit for that? I should. But as soon as you say the problem selected your solution, credit is transferred to the problem. And we're going to see that. That's exactly how this happens when we look at natural selection. So what is natural selection? How is it presented in textbooks? Well, here's a very popular text, Biology Visualizing Life. Darwin not only demonstrated that evolution has occurred, but also proposed its principal mechanism, natural selection. The key factor in natural selection is the what? Environment. Of course it's going to be the environment. It's always the environment. The environment, now this is, I want you to catch the slip. I want you to catch the change right here. The environment presents challenges that individuals with particular traits can better overcome. If you just stopped right there, where would credit in solving the traits go? To the organism, because the organism with particular traits solved them. That's Genesis 1. Then look what the next sentence says. Thus, in this distorted logic, thus, the environment selects which organisms will survive and reproduce. Boom. Credit to the environment. And that's what happens. You're taking credit from what the organism do and you project it onto the environment. This is a famous paper. Everything is everywhere, but the environment selects. And we even see in the classical cavefish. This was a write-up about this cavefish, which changed in one generation. It said, in the classical view of evolution, species experience spontaneous genetic mutations. In this particular case, that wasn't even true. This was not spontaneous genetic mutations. This was an expression of an innate program that produced various novel traits, some helpful, some detrimental. Nature then selects from the most beneficial, passing them on to subsequent generations. It's an elegant model. So credit is continually transferred over to nature. So when we look at natural selection, we observe all of these things, except we never observe the phenotype or the traits being given credit for success or failure of their traits. Credit is always transferred over to the environment, which means there must be a real selection event. If natural selection is a real observable process, we must have some selection event. Well, in order to make selections in real life, something has to have a brain. It has to be able to exercise volition, and things which have a brain and can exercise volition are said to exercise agency. Is there something like a brain in nature, or is there something analogous to a brain in nature which we can really identify out there? What in nature becomes the selector that's similar to a brain which is able to drive organisms through space and time? Well, in natural selection, death always makes the selection. This is the thing that Darwin added. Organisms are able to make traits. How do you select for those traits and deselect? Something has to die. And Darwin added this struggle for resources. He says, in any generation, more offspring are produced than the environment can support. There's going to be a struggle for resources. During the struggle, which ones survive? The fittest survive. And they pass their genes on to others. And the other ones that aren't fit, they what? Die. So Darwin adds this. That is the only thing he added, was something to make selections. In this textbook, I found one that was just the simplest to say it: death is selective. Now, think about this. This is kind of a perverse thing. Does death, in any way possible, have the ability to make a selection? No. Death is just what? It's just death. That's all it is. Death is death. It doesn't really make selections. But this whole idea that death is selective is extended. Here's a famous Californian, Steve Jobs. And at Stanford University, actually right before he died, he gave a commencement address. This is a famous line. Death is very likely the single best invention of life. Death is life's change agent. Yeah. That's what they assert. But this is really, if you're thinking biblically, this is a perversion. Perversion of a biblical view of death. Death in the Bible is not a great invention. Death is a curse. Death is an enemy. Death is going to be destroyed. And so we have this perversion of this thinking. And unfortunately, it's even been picked up in creationist literature. This is a prominent creationist book which says, it puts this covering statement on it, God is able to make good come out of even death itself. Natural selection, though fueled by death, helps the population by getting rid of genetic defects. Well, when we're in a selectionist view, it shouldn't surprise us that we pick up selectionist type of thinking in our view, and we even express things like this. Now, this is another creation ministry, and I love them dearly, but this is a wrong view of the world. Let's actually look and see if these things are really here. So we have a few more quotes to go through. And we're going to go way, way back to right after Darwin publishes his book. Hodge makes this interesting observation in his essay that no one would easily or inadvertently slip into talking about nature as a realm where anything like selection was located, and indeed we find few authors before Darwin making the transition. What he's saying is this: before Darwin, scientific authors never ascribed selective capacity to nature, because authors before Darwin looked at nature and they said nature cannot what? Right, that's right. It cannot select because nature doesn't have a brain. Nature is non-sentient. So nobody was ascribing selective powers to nature before Darwin. Within 5 years of Darwin's book being published, a perpetual secretary of the French Academy of Sciences, Jean-Pierre Flourens, described Darwin's Origin of the Species as metaphysical jargon thrown in myths and natural history, pretentious and silly empty language, supernatural personifications, and stated, quote, that Darwin imagines that his power of selecting, which he gives to nature, is similar to the power of man. This guy is quite perceptive. In 1864, he's saying all Darwin is doing is projecting onto nature selective capacity, which is replacing God's selective capacity on that. This famous Scottish naturalist in 1954 made a very astute observation. It's important to note that in all these processes, there is no selection in the proper meaning of the word. It's unfortunate that Darwin ever introduced the term natural selection, and this man's an evolutionist, for it has given rise to much confusion of thought. He did so, of course, because he arrived at his theory through studying the effects of selection as practiced by men in breeding and domestication. Here, the word is entirely legitimate. But the action of man in selecting and breeding is not analogous to the action of natural selection, but almost the exact opposite. This was a really subtle, unexamined assertion. Darwin saw that human breeders could breed for cattle and stuff and get bigger and smaller cattle and breed for plants as they selected for things. And he said, oh, if man can do this in a short period of time, guess what nature can do by selecting for creatures? And how does nature select it? Bumps the ones, the less fit, off over a long period of time. And he's saying that analogy is entirely illegitimate. Is the analogy illegitimate?
Yes,
it is illegitimate. It's totally illegitimate. And to save time, Jerry Fodor is a militant atheist at Rutgers University. He says the exact same thing. His whole quote says, this analogy is patently flawed. And what he's saying is nobody in the scientific realm is calling Darwin on this failed analogy. Nature cannot select. And so if we were a designer and I successfully designed a space shuttle that landed, made it through the atmosphere and landed, and you're my boss and you say, why did it land? And I say, well, you know, the atmosphere selected for the space shuttle. Or this one which broke up over Texas, my same boss says, well, why did that one fail? I say, well, you know, too bad the atmosphere selected against this one. Nobody in engineering would ever tolerate these kind of silly explanations. But I can show you today, I can show you tomorrow, Monday, a dozen papers in scientific journals where biologists constantly use this language for causality as to why something is here or not. And so Fodor says, familiar claims notwithstanding, Darwin didn't manage to get his mental causes out of his account of how evolution works. He just hid them in the unexamined analogy between selective breeding and natural selection. Wow. This is important because when we look in real design, we see real brains, and we see from the design of organisms that we don't need to appeal to something in nature which can select. But natural selection, which needs this, neither one of these things are detectable. They're totally, absolutely undetectable on this. So, to save time, I'm going to skip over selective pressure. The key thing about selective pressure is, as Ernst Mayr says, it's not real. It's a complete metaphor. Nobody ever has measured anything in nature which can pressure organisms along. Nothing in the environment can drive them in any real sense. So if we're looking in something in nature which actually has a force to act on organisms, that is not found. And that is completely undetectable in terms of selective pressure. Everything that we observe here is in the organism. But the whole act of selecting and selective pressure only takes place in somebody's brain. And when we discuss natural selection, what we actually see is a rational and observable part and some undetectable parts. What we actually observe are these things: systems to express traits, reproduction, inheritance, and changes in frequency. And when I look at all of those, everything that is really observed is 100% innate to the organism. And all of these things which are innate to the organism seem to enable organisms to drive themselves through space and time, solving environmental challenges and filling the earth, just like the scriptures say. And all of these things which are undetectable, an undetectable selector, an undetectable selective pressure, all of these things enable us, unfortunately, to project volition, project agency-like actions onto the environment. There. Now, what is that called? Good Christian. What is it called when we project onto inanimate, non-sentient things?
Superstition.
Superstition. It is superstition. Who said idolatry? Yes, it is idolatry. It's just another subtle. If I held up a statue right before you and I said, this statue can favor you, this statue can act on you, this statue can select for or against. You want a good husband? I mean, you already got one. You want this? You know, this statue can select a good husband for you. You would all see immediately this is idolatry. Darwin doesn't hold up a statue and project volitional capabilities onto it. He holds up what?
Nature.
Nature. And projects volitional capabilities onto it. And this is what a leading evolutionist said. This is just a typical quote. This book was published 2 years ago by Jerry Coyne. He's a full professor at University of Chicago, Why Evolution is True. He says, quote, see if you can find projections in this. Natural selection, we find, is everywhere, scrutinizing individuals, culling the unfit, and promoting the genes of the fitter. It can create intricate adaptations, sometimes in surprisingly little time. Do you see any projections of agency? Natural selection is what? First of all, it's everywhere. You know, Darwin said natural selection is constantly everywhere, scrutinizing every individual for every trait. He makes natural selection basically God. And so natural selection is everywhere, and what is it doing? Scrutinizing individuals. Can nature scrutinize? Can nature cull? Can nature weed out? Or any of these other words we see? No, of course not. And not only does it cull, it promotes, and it even creates intricate adaptations. What we really see is this. We see organisms are everywhere. Organisms have innate capacities within themselves which the Lord put there, enabling them to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Organisms express traits which solve problems, allowing them to fill environments in what? Surprisingly little time. Which is exactly what you would see post-creation, and of course the command to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth is given post-flood. Post-creation and post-flood, we expect to see this. So what we really see here, we see the outworking of God's innate capacities. We see a non-ascription of causality and credit to God, and we see an exchange of ascription of causality and credit to nature. Wow. This is how we see it today, and this should make you sick to kind of think about this, that we see it. So, and someone asks you next time, how would I express it? I would say this. Organisms give all the evidence of having been engineered to adapt, or designed to adapt. Designed to adapt readily. And when I say adapt, since adapt has kind of been perverted by the evolutionist, I really mean organisms self-adjust quite rapidly to these different conditions. And this capacity, which is programmed into them, was put into them by the Lord. And that's a better and more accurate explanation for things. Well, that was all we have. We'll have to come back someday for part 2. Thank you so much for the invitation. I hope this was worth the time.